morning and welcome to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Tuesday, July 26th. I am your reader, Cynthia Pocornar Martinez. We will start with the front page news. And the first one is actually Iowa Department of the Blind recertified. Again, a service enterprise or organization. And the article is by Tim Johnson. Iowa Department for the Blind was recently recertified as a service enterprise initiative organization. Service enterprise organizations fundamentally leverage volunteers and their skills across all levels of the organization to successfully deliver on their mission. Less than 15% of organizations nationwide are characterized as service enterprises. Working through this recertification process has allowed us to continue to expand our understanding of the many ways in which volunteers help us to achieve our mission of empowering blind Iowans to be gainfully employed and live independently, IDB Director Emily Wharton said in a press release. And she says, reflecting on the important role volunteers have played for our agency, we felt especially grateful for the folks who continued to volunteer throughout the pandemic. One particularly striking example is how two of our volunteer narrators read books over a conference line and held discussions to help library patrons to reduce isolation during the earliest months of the pandemic, Wharton said. They just jumped in and made it happen, and our patrons reported that this made a big difference for them in those uncertain times. We are committed to continually finding more opportunities for volunteers to be part of the IDB family. To be designated as a service enterprise, organization staff, board members, and volunteers must participate in the research-based assessment, training, and consulting, the press release stated. This process allows the organization to leverage the skills and expertise of volunteers at all levels. The designation, which is awarded by Points of Light, strengthens the capacity of nonprofits to leverage the skill sets and talents of volunteers to address community needs. The initiative is currently delivered through Volunteer Iowa, part of a national network of service enterprise hubs, which has certified more than 400 organizations across the country since 2012. IDB joins more than 40 organizations across Iowa that have received the Service Enterprise certification. To learn more about Service Enterprise, visit volunteeriowa.org/S-like-Sam-E-like-Eat-I-like-Ice-Cream. Again, it's volunteeriowa.org/S-like-Sam-E-like-Eat-I-like-Ice-Cream, and those three letters are capitalized. Organizations and agencies that are interested in becoming a service enterprise can contact Michelle Raymer, Volunteer Iowa Program Officer, and her phone number is area code 515-348-6235. Again, 515-348-6235. And right next to that is an article promoting a National Night Out, which is coming up on August 2nd, which would be a Tuesday night. And there is a photo at the top of the page with the emergency officers with some children surrounding them and families. And it says Council Bluffs Police Sergeant Jason Bailey hands stickers out to kids during the annual National Night Out event at Lake Manawa State Park on Tuesday, August 3rd, 2021. National Night Out is an annual community building campaign to promote partnerships between police, first responders, and neighborhoods through positive meetings. Nationally, millions of neighbors participate in National Night Out across thousands of communities from all 50 states, U.S. territories, and military bases worldwide, according to a press release from the City of Council Bluffs. Free dinner was served, Walmart held a bicycle raffle, the city gave away door prizes, and representatives from several area agencies were on hand to meet with the public. This article is by David goal bits of the Daily Nonpareil. And the City of Council Bluffs is hosting the 2022 National Night Out Community Building, or National Night Out Community-Building event on Tuesday, August 2nd from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Lake Manawa North Shore Park. And that address is 4200 South 11th Street. The free annual event provides an opportunity for communities to meet and build trust with local law enforcement and first responders. National Night Out is an opportunity to come and interact on a personal level to gain an understanding that the officers and other responders are just like anyone else, Council Bluffs Police Officer Brian Hamilton said. Multiple local agencies will be present at this year's Night Out, including the Council Bluffs Police and Fire Departments, the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office and Emergency Management Agency, the Iowa State Patrol, Iowa DOT Motor Vehicle Enforcement, and LifeNet Air Methods. The LifeNet Medical Helicopter will arrive at 5:45 p.m. and is scheduled to be on site for about an hour, according to Hamilton. Hamilton also said he will be donning a bite suit in order to take part in a K-9 unit demonstration, which will begin around 6:30 p.m. The event will feature free food and giveaways, including t-shirts, water bottles, and footballs while supplies last. There will also be a raffle for a kid's bicycle. This year's sponsors include Warren Highline, Walmart, Coberly's Real Images, and BND Turf Cars. Since its inception in 1984, thousands of communities from all 50 states, U.S. territories, and military bases worldwide have participated in National Night Out. Communities use the evening to get to know their neighbors with block parties, festivals, parades, cookouts, safety demonstrations, seminars, and activities for kids. National Night Out promotes police community partnerships and neighborhood camaraderie with the idea of making neighborhoods safer, more caring places to live, according to the press release. The evening also tries to enhance the relationship between neighbors and law enforcement while bringing back a true sense of community. The event also provides an opportunity to bring police and neighbors together under favorable circumstances. In the event of rain, the Night Out will be held on the following Tuesday, August 9th. For more information, you may visit the City of Council Bluffs Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofcb. And that's facebook.com/cityofcb. And at the bottom of that article, there is a small map that shows where the sponsors will be and where the helicopter is going to be, parking and that sort of thing. And the other article at the top of the front page here, let me get to that, is entitled Reynolds Criticizes Biden, and with strong polling, money advantages, digs aimed at National Democrats. This is an article by Aaron Murphy from the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A little more than 3 months out from Election Day, the early measurables suggest Kim Reynolds, Iowa's Republican governor, is a heavy favorite to earn another four-year term as the state's chief executive. Reynolds has dominated the campaign's fundraising efforts, and early polling suggests she is overwhelmingly the choice of Iowa voters. Four top national elections forecasters all rate Iowa's gubernatorial race in their strongest category for a Reynolds win. Deidre DeGeer, the Des Moines businesswoman and the Democratic challenger, has lagged far behind Reynolds in fundraising and polling. DeGeer has been attempting to make up that difference on the ground by hosting public campaign events across the state. While withholding a comfortable lead in the polls while running for re-election in a state that has a low opinion of the Democratic president Joe Biden's performance, Reynolds appeared satisfied, at least early in the campaign, to focus her criticism on Biden and congressional Democrats rather than on her opponent, DeGeer. Reynolds frequently blasts Biden and Democrats in Congress, In her media appearances, she rarely mentions DeGere. With Governor Reynolds having the lead, she doesn't necessarily have to talk about issues. The challenge for DeGere will be to bring the issues to the governor, said Donna Hoffman, a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Certainly, Governor Reynolds can try to nationalize this election because it's in her best interest to do that. Run against Joe Biden, run against Joe Biden's policy. Tie Deidre DeGere to Joe Biden. Reynolds was chosen by national Republicans to deliver the party's response to Biden's State of the Union address in January. Reynolds' campaign declined to comment for the story. At a campaign event this past week in Cedar Rapids, DeGere said she is focused on reaching out to Iowans. She says, "I don't necessarily need the governor to engage me. We all know that I am the governor's opponent, not President Joe Biden." And she says, it's, hold on just a second. My screen did something weird here. And it's clear to me now, more than anything, especially as consistently that she has mentioned his name, that her perspective or focus is not on Iowa. Her focus is on something else, and we need leadership in the state to focus on us. She goes on to say, "Who needs my attention? Iowans. Iowans need my attention. Iowans need the attention of their governor. So if she says my name or not, it's not the end of the world. What's more important is that we connect with the voter. That's who I'm focused on." DeGere said she plans to travel to all 99 Iowa counties, a practice made famous by longtime Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, to reach voters in all corners of the state and to continue to raise money for the campaign. And DeGere said the early poll results do not concern her. Over the past week, the Des Moines Register / MediaCom poll, considered by many to be the gold standard in Iowa politics, showed Reynolds with a 17-point lead, and a poll commissioned by Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation showed Reynolds with a 15-point lead. Rick Stewart, the Libertarian Party candidate for governor, was at 5% in the Iowa poll. DeGere says, "We knew that this was going to be a hard race, but where we are right now is it's really about digging deep and working our plans, and we'll see the fruits of our labor." Tim Hagel, a University of Iowa political science professor, said there still is time for DeGere to chip away at Reynolds' lead because many voters are not yet turned in to the 2022, or tuned in rather, excuse me, tuned in to the 2022 election campaigns. And because many voters have not yet become familiar enough with DeGere to form an opinion about her. Having said all that, yeah, a 17-point lead is pretty big, Hagel said. Hagel and UNI's Hoffman said Reynolds came into the campaign with at least two key foundational advantages. Iowans historically like to vote for their incumbents, regardless of political party, and Biden's low job approval numbers nationally and in Iowa could make it hard for Democratic candidates to win here, especially statewide. Most national polling aggregators show Biden's average approval rating in the 30s and disapproval rating in the upper 50s. Even though technically he's not on the ballot, everybody knows that, effectively, a midterm election is a report card on how the president's doing in the first 2 years of the administration, Hagel said. And for the Biden administration, it's not looking too good. And so that's what allows Republicans to focus their attention perhaps on him and what's going on there rather than necessarily your opponent. The general election will be November 8th in Iowa. Early voting will start on October 19th. And the final article off the front page is Griswold Group Fundraises for Child Care Center by Tim Johnson. The Noble Initiative Foundation is raising money for construction of a new child development center in Griswold. The foundation aims to raise $2.3 million to build the 8,800-square-foot facility, which will serve about 100 children, according to Jared Wyman, president of the foundation's board of directors. So far, the group has raised $1.6 million for the project, Wyman said. We would not be where we are without the generous support of our community, he said. It has been truly humbling to see the number of people who want to get involved and donate their time and resources. The center will provide year-round child care, including full-time, drop-in, and before and after school care, according to a press release from the foundation. The structure, which will be located south of Griswold Elementary School, will contain 4 child care rooms to accommodate children from 6 weeks old to 4 years. There will be a separate area for before and after school care for elementary school age children. The Noble Initiative Foundation was formed in 2018 when the Community United Methodist Church closed its doors and donated $65,000 of its remaining funds to start a licensed child care center, Wyman said. Griswold Communications matched it. Like most communities, our parents commute, so they need to be able to drop off the kids in the morning and pick them up after work, he said. The foundation expects to hold a groundbreaking ceremony this fall and open the Child Development Center by the summer of 2024. If you want more information, you may visit NobleInitiativeFoundation.org. And that's going to bring us to our behind page one section. And I'm going to go read my favorite section, which is Face of the Day. And we've got a perky looking dog. He's a sweetheart. And let's see, 1 second. And his name is Griffin. The dog is as loving as he is handsome, and he wants to charm some humans into a new forever home. Griffin is a 5-year-old male German Shepherd who is currently available for adoption at Midlands Humane Society. Shelter staff members describe him as energetic, playful, friendly, and funny. He's eager to find a loving family to call his own. His adoption fee is $225, which covers altering age-appropriate vaccines and a microchip. In other shelter news, Midlands has announced that its annual Wags and Wheels car show fundraiser will take place August 28th. It will be the 5th year for the event, and people should keep an eye out for details in the near future. Wags and Wheels takes place in the Thunder Bowl parking lot, which will be filled with local entry classic cars and other cool rides. Some furry friends like Griffin might even be there looking for a family. Vehicle entries and sponsorship opportunities are still available, and interested parties can get more information by calling the shelter. So if you want to call the shelter, the phone number is 712-396-2270. Again, 712-396-2270. And there's a little correction here. In Saturday's story on West Fair, which begins today, the event was incorrectly referred to as the 2020 Fair on the first reference. So they should have said 2022. And then our top article here on behind page one is a Missouri Valley woman killed in a single vehicle accident by David Golbitz. A 21-year-old Missouri Valley woman was killed early Sunday morning in a single vehicle accident when the vehicle in which she was a passenger left the road and crashed. Shortly before 3 a.m., a 2019 Chevy Cruze driven by Quinton Vogel, 21, of Missouri Valley, was heading south on 335th Street, approaching a curve in the road at the Merrick Place intersection. Vogel apparently failed to negotiate the curve, and the car left the road and struck 2 trees, according to the Iowa State Patrol crash report. As a result of the accident, the passenger, Faith Staska, died. Vogel was taken by Missouri Valley Ambulance to CHI Health Center in Omaha with undisclosed injuries. Both Staska and Vogel were wearing seatbelts, according to the report. Missouri Valley Police, Fire, Ambulance, and the Harrison County Sheriff's Office assisted at the scene. The next article, Capitol Notebook, is Greg to lead National Lieutenant Governor's Group. And this is an article by the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg was elected as the next chair of the National Lieutenant Governors Association at the organization's annual meeting Monday, the Iowa Governor's Office announced. Gregg will serve for 1 year as chairman-elect and then become the organization's chairman at the next annual meeting, which will be held in Des Moines on August 2023. He says, I'm honored to be chosen by my peers to assume this leadership role. The National Lieutenant Governors Association, NLGA, is a place where lieutenant governors share ideas and best practices to advance opportunities for our states and our constituents. We work to find effective ways to address new problems, foster cooperation between states, and generally improve effectiveness in our states. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds is a previous chairwoman of the organization. She served from 2015 to 2016. Lottery winner. A lucky lottery ticket buyer is in line for $25,000 a year for life thanks to a winning ticket that was purchased Sunday at a convenience store in Black Hawk County, the state lottery announced. Excuse me. The winning ticket matched the first five numbers but missed the lucky ball in Sunday's Lucky for Life drawing, yielding the second prize of $25,000 for life. The winning ticket was purchased at Get and Go on Wood Street in Hudson, the lottery said. A Davenport man claimed a similar prize in June. Top prizes must be claimed at the Iowa Lottery headquarters in Clive. Details can be found at iowalottery.com, and that's ialottery.com. And winners with questions may call the lottery phone number at 515-725-7900. Farm to School, a program designed to connect Iowa schools with locally grown food, is set to receive a boost from a nearly $100,000 grant to the State Education Department. It is the second Farm to School grant that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has awarded to the Iowa Department of Education, the state agency announced. The total grant is a split of nearly $68,000 from the Federal Agricultural Department and $25,000 from the State Ag Department. It is a two-year grant period that will cover the 2022-23 and 2023-24 school years. The program is designed to increase the availability of local foods in schools and provide educational programming on the sustainability and impact of healthy eating on overall wellness, the State Education Department said. And this is a quote by Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig in a recent news release. It's a win-win when we can assist our schools with providing nutritious and delicious meals to Iowa students while also building demand and markets for locally grown and produced Iowa products. Initiatives like the Farm to School program are important because they help to shorten the distance from farm to plate, improve our supply chain resiliency, and foster long-term connections between students, schools, and farmers. Disaster proclamation. Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for five northeast Iowa counties in response to recent severe weather. The proclamation covers Alla McKee, Clayton, Harrison, Shelby, and Winneshiek counties and makes state resources available to assist in response to and recovery from the severe weather. The proclamation also makes available to low-income households, grants for home or car repairs, or replacing clothing or food. It says to low-income household grants for home or care repairs. So not sure about that, but replacing clothing or food. And the next article is Hinson talks inflation, transportation with Vinton merchants. And there's a the caption underneath the photo says, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson talks with owners Terry and Sue Hart of Brickside Brew and Chew in Vinton, Iowa on Monday, July 25th. The Harts recently opened the coffee shop that serves coffee, tea, and drinks. They say the rising cost of goods has made it more expensive to run their business, and they have to pass that cost off to the customers. Challenger says Hinson voted against bills to help Iowans. This is an article by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. In Vinton, Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson talked inflation, transportation, and drug costs with small business owners during a stop Monday in Vinton. Republicans, including Hinson, have criticized President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats for driving record inflation due to what they've termed reckless spending, creating a tax on middle and working class families. Hinson also blamed Biden's administration for being too restrictive on domestic oil production. Democrats note job numbers and unemployed rates have improved under Biden. But even as the economy has quickly amassed jobs, inflation has left many workers feeling worse off as wages have not kept pace. High inflation is a major political liability for Biden and congressional Democrats, who have blamed Republicans for blocking their ideas to lower prices for Americans. Hinson says Republicans are not standing in the way. And she's arguing the Democrats' proposal containing poison pills that Republicans just cannot support. She pointed to the Consumer Fuel Price Gouging Prevention Act that passed the House in May but failed to advance in the Senate. The bill would give Biden the power to crack down on oil and gas price gouging. Republicans, including Hinson, unanimously opposed the bill along with four Democrats. Hinson argued the bill amounted to pushing government price controls, which supporters deny that would lead to even less oil and gas production at a time when the Biden administration should ramp up domestic production and turn to Iowa's biofuels to bolster the nation's fuel supply and bring prices down at the pump. She noted her support of legislation that passed the House last month to allow for the year-round sale nationwide of E15 ethanol blend, similar to provisions included in an executive order recently signed by Biden. Hinson, too, pointed to her support for bipartisan legislation co-sponsored with Democratic U.S. Representative Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Kurt Schrader of Oregon, aimed to combat inflation and help lower the price of goods and services. The legislation, called the Informed Lawmaking to Combat Inflation Act, directs the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office to analyze the inflationary effects of pending legislation with a significant budgetary impact and provide members of Congress with that information before voting on such bills. Hinson and Murphy have said requiring members of Congress to understand the inflationary impact of their actions will be key to getting inflation under control. Democratic challenger Liz Mathis, a state senator from Hiawatha who is running this year for the seat, argues Hinson has voted against bipartisan bills that would help Iowans, including voting against the bipartisan infrastructure bill, while taking credit for funding to modernize and expand locks and dams on the Mississippi River made possible under the law. Hinson spoke out against the infrastructure bill and voted against it, but later was included in a bipartisan letter to the Army Corps of Engineers to request that funds be allocated for use on the river. Hinson said she opposed the act because it was tied to social spending. However, she said the money was going to be spent regardless once the bill was signed into law. Mathis also criticized Hinson for opposing a measure to allow Medicare to negotiate with drug companies to lower prices. Hinson, instead, is a co-sponsor of legislation her office says seeks to lower prescription drug costs by bringing new treatments to the market, increases transparency and accountability for drug manufacturers, and provides an out-of-pocket cap for seniors in the Medicare Part D program. Yet again, Representative Hinson is telling Iowans one thing here at home, then going to Washington and voting with her party bosses against bipartisan bills to help Iowa, Mathis said. She voted against bipartisan infrastructure projects to improve our transportation system and get the supply chain moving to bring down costs. Hinson, during her visit with Vinton business owners, also highlighted legislation she's introduced that would, quote, help prop up rural manufacturing, end quote, and modernize existing law to help workers access voluntary skills, training, and educational opportunities. The Marion Republican introduced a bill that would amend the Fair Labor Standards Act to exempt employers from having to pay employees overtime for training and similar activities outside of work. The bill would exclude time spent attending or participating in lectures, classes, or training programs from hours worked, regardless of whether the activity is offered or facilitated by the employer. Provided attendance is voluntary and outside the employee's regular working hours. The employee does not perform any productive work during attendance, and not participating will not adversely affect their employment and working conditions. All right, listeners, you have been listening to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for today, Tuesday, July 26th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And we're going to turn to today's obituaries. Zella M. Wold Shaw. Zella, age 98, a lifelong resident of Council Bluffs, passed away July 23rd. Zella was born March 27th in 1924 to the late Joseph and Edna Ellis Cunningham. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1941. Zella married Benjamin C. Wold in 1942. They were blessed with four children, and they are as follows: Ben Jr., Cheryl, Wayne, and Bruce. Zella retired from Iowa Western Community College after 30 years of service. She was self-reliant, caring, and dignified. Zella led an active, healthy, and fulfilling life. Zella was preceded in death by her husband, Ben Wold Sr., 1975, a son, Bruce Wold, just here in 2022, and her sister, Ruby Mosier, in 1997. Zella is survived by her sons, Ben Jr. and spouse Carol Wold of Northville, Michigan, Wayne and spouse Connie Wold, and daughter Cheryl Jansen, both of Council Bluffs. Her eight grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. Her brother, James, and spouse Marilyn Cunningham of North Las Vegas, Nevada. Funeral services are this Thursday at 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment is Cedar Lawn Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. That address is 1350 East Pierce Street. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Thursday at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to Community of Christ Riverside Congregation. The next obituary is for Dale E. Lane, and he was 90 years old. Dale was born September 17, 1931, to the late William and Elsie Lane in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He passed away July 23rd at his residence in Council Bluffs, surrounded by his family. Dale was a graduate of Thomas Jefferson High School. He enlisted in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War and served as a naval tail gunner from 1951 to 1955. Dale married Karen Bogardus on December 2, 1955 in Council Bluffs. He was a salesman for the Omaha Paper Company and retired after 23 years of service. After that, Dale was a car transporter for over 10 years for Superior Honda. He was a member of the American Legion, VFW, and the Optimist Club. Dale is preceded in death by his parents, brothers William and Daryl, a son-in-law, Dale Rockwell. He is survived by his wife of 66 years, Karen, a daughter, Vicki Rockwell, son, Robert, and spouse, Jackie Lane, five grandchildren and six great-grandchildren, numerous nieces and nephews. Memorial visitation is Wednesday, July 27th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Memorial service is Thursday, July 28th at 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Interment is in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Memorials may be directed by the family. And the last one for today is Everett Carl Wilson. He was age 80 and he passed away peacefully at Jenny Edmondson Hospital on July 24th. He was born November 22nd in 1941 to the late Everett and Mildred Fowler Wilson in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Carl graduated from Underwood High School with the class of 60 and operated Wilson Landscaping Service. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by his sister, Viola Lawrence. Everett is survived by his wife of 59 years, Judy Wilson, sons Bill and spouse Michelle Wilson, Neil and spouse Tony Wilson, and Ryan and spouse Laurel Wilson. Sister Rosie Benson, eight grandchildren and four great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Holy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Wednesday, July 27th. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Thursday, July 28th. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to Wings of Hope or the charity of your choice. And our sympathies go out to all the families and friends of the people that we just learned about. I'm going to read this short article that's right next to the obituaries. It says, poll, 2 in 3 Americans favor term limits for justices. It's an article out of the Swanson Associated Press. And it reads as follows. About 2 in 3 Americans say they favor term limits or a mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices, according to a new poll that finds a sharp increase in the percentage of Americans saying they have hardly any confidence in the court. The poll from the Associated Press and NORG Center for Public Affairs Research finds 67% of Americans support a proposal to set a specific number of years that justices serve instead of life terms, including 82% of Democrats and 50% of Republicans. Views are similar about a requirement that justices retire by a specific age. The poll was conducted just weeks after the High Court issued high-profile rulings, including stripping away women's constitutional protections for abortion and expanding gun rights. The poll also shows more Americans disapprove than approve of the court's abortion decision, with just over half saying the decision made them angry or sad. The court, which is now taking a summer break, will return to hearing cases in October with diminished confidence among Americans. Now, 43% say they have hardly any confidence in the court, up from 27% 3 months ago. Inez Parker of Curry, North Carolina, said she's among those who strongly favor limits on justices' service. I think some of those people have been up there too long. They don't have new ideas. When you get a certain age and everything, you get set in your ways, just like I'm set in my ways, said the 84-year-old Democrat. Parker said retired justices can work in their garden, sit on the porch, and fan flies or whatever they want to do. The Constitution gives federal judges, including Supreme Court justices, life tenure, but there have been recent calls for change. A commission tasked by President Joe Biden with examining potential changes to the Supreme Court studied term limits, among other issues. The commission finished its work last year, and its members were ultimately divided over whether they believed Congress has the power to pass a law creating the equivalent of term limits. Phil Bowler, 90, of La Follette, Tennessee, said he's not totally opposed to setting a limit on years of service for justices. The Republican who worked in broadcasting and later owned his own lawn care business said that, quote, basically, it's worked the way it's been going, and I see no reason to change that, end quote. The oldest member of the current court is Justice Clarence Thomas, 74, followed by Justice Samuel Alito, 72. But recent justices have served into their 80s. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg served until her death in 2020 at age 87. Justice Anthony Kennedy retired in 2018 at 81. And Justice Stephen Breyer just retired at age 83. Ginsburg served for 27 years, Kennedy 30 years, and Breyer nearly 28 years. Okay, and heading on over to the sports page. There is a baseball card at the center of this page being held by someone, and it is signed by Mickey Mantle. The mint condition 1952 Mickey Mantle baseball card is expected to sell well into the millions when bidding ends at the end of the month. 1952 Mantle baseball card going up for auction. It out of New York, a decades-old mint-condition Mickey Mantle baseball card could break a record at the auction. The collector's item from 1952 features one of baseball's most celebrated and charismatic legends and is widely regarded as one of just a handful in near-perfect condition. It's estimated the final cost of the card could exceed $10 million when the auction ends August 27th. The record is $6.6 million for a 1909 Honus Wagner card that was sold at auction a year ago, months after another 70-year-old Mantle card fetched $5.2 million. Interest was already heavy Monday when the auction debuted online, with bidding already up to at least $4.2 million. No matter the final price for the rare Mantle rookie card, it will be a hefty profit for the current owner, a New Jersey waste management entrepreneur who bought it for $50,000 at a New York City show in 1991. Every time he got up to the plate, the crowd would go crazy, the roars would be there, and he never disappointed you. He had that aura about him. Card owner Anthony Giordano said of Mantle, who spent his entire career with the New York Yankees from 1951 to 1968. Whether you're from the New York area or not, or a Yankees fan, it was always Mickey Mantle that was highlighted. The switch-hitting Mantle, the Mick, was a Triple Crown winner in 1956, a three-time American League MVP, and a seven-time World Series champion. The Hall of Famer, who died in 1995, was considered a humble player on the field. When he hit a home run, he would often run the bases with his head bowed. I figured the pitcher already felt bad enough without me showing him up rounding the bases, Mantle once said. As for the baseball card, its rarity is on par with its subject's mythical reputation. The quality of the card is the key, said Derek Grady, the executive vice president of sports auctions for Heritage Auctions, which is running the bidding. Four sharp corners, the gloss and the color jumps off the card. Grady said that the collectibles market is having a renaissance, noting that cards that are, quote, the creme de la creme, the best of the best, are still selling despite the economy right now, end quote. And that Mantle, the king of baseball cards, has always done well. Giordano, 75, said it was time to give the Mantle card a new home. It's the right thing to do, he said. My boys and I have had the card for over 30 years, and we've enjoyed it. We've enjoyed showing anybody that's close to me, friends and relatives, and I think it's time for someone else. The card will be on display in Atlantic City from Wednesday through Sunday at the National Sports Collectors Convention and at the New York Office of Heritage Auctions the following week. That's a lot of money. And another local news article, Newgarden out of hospital, Ferrucci on standby. And there's a picture, a photo, of Joseph Newgarden holding the trophy after winning Saturday's IndyCar Series race at Iowa Speedway in Newton, Iowa. Two-time IndyCar champion Joseph Newgarden was released from a Des Moines hospital on Monday and returned to his Tennessee home, where he will wait for an evaluation to determine if he can race this weekend at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Team Penske named Santino Ferrucci as its standby driver in case Newgarden is not medically cleared to compete on the road course at Indianapolis. Newgarden collapsed in the motorhome lot Sunday at Iowa Speedway following a late crash in a race he had dominated. Although the American was cleared by the IndyCar medical staff after his crash, he later lost consciousness and fell to the ground in the bus lot, striking the back of his head. He was airlifted from the track in Newton to Mercy One Des Moines Medical Center to speed the 45-minute journey and avoid traffic from the post-race Blake Shelton concert. Team Penske said Sunday night that all tests on Newgarden had been negative, but he was hospitalized overnight for further evaluation. Newgarden was already scheduled for a Thursday evaluation in Indianapolis to determine if he can compete Saturday. Per IndyCar regulations, a driver receives a secondary evaluation when a crash registers more than 80 G-forces. There was no immediate word from IndyCar or Team Penske on the force of Newgarden's hit, but the scheduled second medical check would indicate his hit exceeded the threshold. Newgarden, who won Saturday's race, dominated and led the 148 of the 300 laps while trying to sweep the doubleheader weekend. But something on his Team Penske car broke with 64 laps remaining, and the 31-year-old from Tennessee spun hard into the outside wall, creating an opening for Pato O'Ward of Aero McLaren SP to win the race. Newgarden was visibly rattled after his mandatory check in the infield care center after the crash. He said the crash into the wall, quote, definitely rocked me. I got a little bit shaken from it, but I'm okay, end quote. Definitely was a bit of a shot. I'd want to cry. So sad for my team. I don't know what happened, Newgarden said. Everything felt fine to me. Totally unexpected, and it caught me by surprise. Team Penske is the best. I never have this stuff, so maybe we were due. Chevrolet's initial diagnosis was that the suspension broke on Newgarden's car. Newgarden was showing as the IndyCar points leader at the time of his crash. He's now tied for third in his standings with Scott Dixon. Ferrucci was the replacement driver for Jack Harvey at Texas Motor Speedway earlier this year when Harvey suffered a concussion. He also ran the Indianapolis 500 and finished 10th. Ferrucci is also scheduled to race the Xfinity Series event this shared weekend between NASCAR and IndyCar. The U.S. women's team has a new vibe, and there's a photo above this article of Alex Morgan. She's taking a selfie as she and the U.S. team celebrate after winning the CONCACAF F Women's Championship final soccer match against Canada in Monterrey, Mexico on July 1st. And the U.S. women's team has a new vibe. The transformation of the U.S. women's national team has been significant in the years since the Tokyo Games. The defending World Cup champions have a new look with young talent, and coach Vlatko Andonovski has tweaked the team's traditional straightforward and speedy attack to take a more nuanced approach. The players say something more is going on as well. There's been a shift in the team's vibe. The United States is coming off the CONCACAFW Championship, where they secured a spot in the 2023 World Cup and also the 2024 Paris Olympics. Although they looked somewhat disorganized at the start of the tournament in Monterrey, Mexico, they outscored opponents 13-0 and secured the title with a victory over rival Canada, a team that beat them at the Olympics. The vibes with the team are really incredible, midfielder Andy Sullivan said after the team lifted the tournament trophy. She says the blend between the senior leaders and the young players, for some it's their first tournament, or for some players this is their umpteenth tournament, and I think that blend is incredible. That energy after a long trip, a long tournament, it was one of the most joyous days that we had. The last article I'm going to read is a sad one. This is a photo of a family that was vacationing at the Maquoketa Caves State Park. It's Sarah Schmidt and her daughter Lula Schmidt and son Arlo Schmidt and looks like her husband Tyler Schmidt in a picture posted on a family member's Facebook page. Arlo, who is 9, survived the attack at Maquoketa Caves State Park. They were attacked in their tent. 3 members of the family murdered at Maquoketa Caves State Park early Friday were in their tent at the time. That was confirmed by officials. Mitch Mordvit, assistant director of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation, said Sarah and Tyler Schmidt, both 42, and their daughter Lula, 6, were attacked and killed in their tent. The couple's son, Arlo, 9, survived. The family lived in Cedar Falls, Iowa, where Sarah worked for the public library. Police have identified 23-year-old Anthony Sherwin as the suspect in the slayings. He was found dead in a wooded area of the park from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Autopsies were to be performed Sunday and Monday, Mordvit said, and the preliminary results are likely to be announced on Tuesday or Wednesday. He told the Associated Press over the weekend that the motive for the attack remains unknown. He says, "We don't know what led up to this, what precipitated it. The investigation has not revealed any early interaction between the Schmidt family and him, Sherwin." Cecilia Sherwin, Anthony Sherwin's mother, told the Omaha World-Herald in an email Saturday that the family refuses, quote, to believe the news, end quote. Cecilia Sherwin said they were camping at the park Friday morning when she heard yelling and 2 gunshots. A young boy ran up to the Sherwin's campsite yelling for help and told her that a man wearing black had shot his family. Cecilia Sherwin said her son was wearing green, not black, and no black clothing was found in the area. She also said that they were legally traveling with a gun, which was located in a secure container. We think Anthony might have sensed trouble and grabbed the gun for safety, Cecilia Sherwin said. We refuse to believe the news. We are deeply saddened as he had so much to live for and gave us no indication that anything was wrong. A review of Nebraska criminal records found no signs that Sherwin had a criminal history. In a second email to the World Herald, the suspect's mother said she and her family cooperated fully with the police and investigative team from the get-go. I didn't think we had any tears left, but we still find ourselves breaking down and care deeply for the little boy and the loss of his family, she said, adding that her son gave us no warning that he was planning anything of this sort. She again expressed doubt that he had killed the Schmidt, saying, quote, Anthony was not capable of this sort of violence, end quote. As of Monday, more than $200,000 in donations had been set to for a fund for Arlo Schmidt. And our deepest sympathies goes out to the family. Well, folks, that does it for today's reading of the Daily Nonpareil for today, Tuesday, July 26th. I'm your reader, Cynthia Pocorna Martinez. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a peaceful day.